Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Heil, and I'm an alcoholic. And since April the 12th of 1990, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol or other mood-altering substance, and that's been the best thing that's ever happened to me. And it's good to be here. And pay real close attention, because if you get the tape or the CD, you won't be able to hear anything, as they said. Since it's not recording. No, it's really neat to be here. I appreciate it. What a beautiful, beautiful place to be sober. And I love men's groups. You know, we have one of these back home that started about 6 years ago. And I go to one in Texas called the Texas Man-to-Man Conference. It's every May. I've been going to that for about 10 years. And there's something special, you know, when a bunch of guys get together in AA. You know, it's just a... It's hard to explain what the bond is and the specialness is, and it's neat to have a lot of new guys here, you know, because that makes me feel more comfortable. And being my first time here, I've been working on this. 2 weeks ago, I was in Ottawa, got to speak up there, and I've been working on my A's, you know. So something goes like, "How y'all doing?" A, here I am. Not quite there, but I love Alcoholics Anonymous no matter where I go, and looking forward to getting to meeting all of you this weekend and spending some time and, you know, talking about this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know we got, you know, a lot of new people here, and what I thought I'd do tonight is, you know, tell you my story, because that's all I really have. You know, the really neat part about what we have is that we have a book and we have a thing called the steps. But what makes Alcoholics Anonymous what it is that, you know, it started with one alcoholic sharing his story, his experience, strength, and hope with another guy. And, you know, I say this because, you know, we live in an age of great knowledge today about AA, right? We have books to read the book. We have tapes on how to read the big book. We have workshops. We have recovery dynamics. We have all kinds of things. But you know what? It still comes down, you know, to one alcoholic, eyeball to eyeball, face to face. And that's why I really like these types of deals, you know, because you don't have to listen to me drone on all weekend. But you know, the real neat deal will be is that, and I hope to get out and talk to some of you one-on-one, you know, sitting on a rock and sharing experience, strength, and hope. Because what I can tell you guys is that, you know, I've had great sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been very, very fortunate and gotten to know guys like Tom I and you know, just my sponsor is a guy named Don M., little lawyer from Louisville. Don's about 28 years sober, I guess, now. But, you know, with all the great leadership that I've had, you know, the really neat thing is that it's the guys who spent time with me, you know, before the meeting, after the meeting, sit in the parking lot, you know, listened to me and met me for coffee, you know, and I never want to forget that because, you know, I like to take my time out today when I'm asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sharing with a couple of you, I actually was in Phoenix before I came up here. I had a business meeting, and it was one of those corporate type of business things. And for the last two nights, I had to go out to dinner, right? These companies were taking us out to dinner, you know, and you know how those things are. You know, you have to sit there and listen to these drunks drone on for, you know, about 2 or 3 hours. Friday night, you know, I got trapped with the drunkest guy in the restaurant, you know. I mean, this guy he's spitting when he's talking. You know, we went from politics to football to fishing, and the whole restaurant's watching us, you know. And, you know, I was just so wanting to get up here, you know, and get up here with my people. Get up here with my people. And I was just telling Jules outside, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I really have come just to cherish, you know, being able to talk to another man and actually talk to him and actually listen to what he says and actually share something other than lying about girls and my past athletic, you know, feats and the stuff we always did in the bars. And, you know, that's what we get to do here, you know. And I sometimes take it for granted when I'm hanging around AA. But you get in one of those situations, those business things like I was in the last two nights, where you have to stand there and jabber on about all the insane, inane stuff that you have to, and you just realize how special it is in the relationship we have here. I was telling the guys, I got to the airport today and had a young customs guy. You know how they do now. You know, they're trying to shake you down. So I gave a guy my little paper, and he starts asking me questions. He said, "What are you here for?" I said, "I'm here to see some friends." He said, "Well, name them." I said, I only know one, Rick. He said, you only know one of your friends. You don't know the rest of their names. I said, I will. I'll know them tonight. And he just kind of looks at me. What kind of organization is this? I said, it's a good organization. He said, what do you mean? What kind is it? I said, well, it's kind of a social organization. You know, and he just would not let go. So finally I said, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. And this kid just kind of looks up at me like that. And he goes, is that a volunteer organization? Unbelievable. And he finally handed my stuff and I went on through, you know. Unbelievable. You know, I will say this to you. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about you guys, but I grew up in a little bitty world. You know, what I know today about alcoholism is that, you know, our world gets very small. Now, I'm an Irish Catholic from Kentucky, all right? Grew up the oldest of seven kids. You know, I remember one time I was about 10 years old. My dad says to me one day, he said, Timmy, here's all you need to know about living is this. Irish Catholic from Kentucky. In football, you pull for Notre Dame. In basketball, you pull for Kentucky. And you vote the straight Democratic ticket. Now, that's it, kid. Get out there and live, you know? And I say that because that's kind of the mindset that I started out with. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, April 12th of 1990, you know, that world had gotten even much smaller than that, you know, because it was down to me, nobody else. And if, you know, you didn't want my world, I didn't want you in my world, you know, that's just the way it had gotten to be. And I say that because, you know, today, sometimes I have to pinch myself, you know, and I'm standing in the middle of the woods in Vancouver, Canada. And 2 weeks ago, I was in Ottawa, Canada. And last week, I was in New Mexico. You know, and a guy like me, if you knew how I grew up, just wasn't supposed to go to places like that. And it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's one simple thing, you know. And I just love it to death. I was telling some guys, my home group is called the Lampton Street Group, and it's in the inner city down in Louisville. I mean, it's in the hood. I mean, it is down in the inner city. I got involved down there because my office is not too far from it. But I'll tell you a story. It's one of my favorite AA stories. About 2 years ago, and probably as a result of where my home group is, probably 75-80% of the guys I sponsor are African-American men or black men. You know, it's just the way it is down the city. And we're around all the halfway houses and the treatment centers. So, but I don't think a whole lot about it. It's just, you know, the way it is in Alcoholics Anonymous. But a couple years ago, down around that area, they changed the street from a one-way street to a two-way street. You know, and I was ready to get on the expressway one day. And I'm only about three blocks from my home group now. And keep in mind, but all of a sudden, I was getting ready to turn left, and pow, his car hits me in the back. And I get out, and it was this elderly black man and his wife, you know, and they had hit me. They didn't realize it was now a one-way street. And, you know, we're standing there waiting for the police to come, you know, when you have an accident. Well, all of a sudden, here comes two guys down this side of the street, both black men. They run over to me. They say, hey, Tim, how you doing, man? Are you okay? Are you okay? I said, yeah. I said, guys, go ahead. I'm all right. About that time, here come two other guys. They're both black men. They ran over to me. Tim, you okay? Anything we can do for you, partner? I said, no, I'm okay, guys. Go ahead. About that time, car came off expressway. Five guys in there, all black. They stopped the car and said, Tim, are you hurt? Can we take you to the hospital? I said, no, guys, I'm all right. Go ahead. I didn't think anything about it. I turned around, and an elderly black man was standing there. He went, who are you anyway? You know, and what could I tell that guy, you know? How could I explain to him what just happened there, you know? Our book talks about, you know, we are people who normally would not mix, but what grows up amongst us is a fellowship that's indescribably wonderful, you know, I mean. And, you know, the deal is, you know, I can go on and on. My sponsor one time sent me to talk down at a Cherokee Indian Reservation down in Cherokee, North Carolina. And I was just starting to do this, and, you know, I was all nervous about it. And one of the things I noticed right away, I was the only non-Native American speaker. You know, I do not look like an Indian. And, you know, 6'4", you know, blonde hair. And I'm a little nervous. I look out there, and there's the chief sitting there, and there's the medicine man sitting there. And, you know, man, I am just nervous as I can be. And the next thing that comes out of my mouth is, hey, guys, you know what? When I was a kid and I used to watch those Cowboys and Indians movies, I pulled for the Indians. I swear I did. I looked at the chief. He finally started to laugh a little bit. And after the thing, he came up to me. He said, you know, boy, we kind of worried about you, but when you told that lie up there, we knew you were in the right place. You know, it's just great. I mean, I go on and on. And, you know, the places I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I spoke a couple, 2 years ago at the Midwest Motorcycle Rally of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was like the Woodstock. It was out in an area like this, and all the guys came on their motorcycles from all over the place, and they headed outside. And it just, you know, sometimes I just, you know, it's interesting when you leave home, you know, people in my office go, "Where are you going?" I go, "Well, I'm going to Vancouver." "Why?" You know, I mean, they're finally starting to catch on. I was telling a story the other day when I first got into Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about anonymity, and as if anybody didn't know, I didn't have a problem in my office, but I didn't think a whole lot about it. And first 6-8 weeks, and they told me to get a lot of guys' names, and I did, and, you know, was calling them, and they were calling me, and I didn't think a whole lot of thing about it. But so one day I'm out doing my sales calls. I'm about 4 months sober, and I called in. There's a little girl named Tammy who answered. You know, she was our receptionist. I said, "Tammy, give me my calls." She said, "All right, Tim, here they are." She said, "Joe called, and he said, thanks for last night." Said, "Tommy called and said, could they get together tonight?" Dave called and said, "Could they have lunch tomorrow?" And she said, "There's one more." I said, "All right, go ahead and read it." She said, "Well, Jimmy called, and he just wants you to know that he loves you." And I said, "Tammy, look, when I get in there, we need to have a talk." And you know what? That particular day, though, I went in, I talked to her, and I told her my story. As sometimes, you know, the book says if we stay on the firing line of life, you know, you will know the time to do it. And that was one of those days. And as it turned out, she had a daddy who was an alcoholic, and she had a husband who was well on the way, you know. So, you know, that's been my experience. I don't know about yours. Is that you promised me if I stayed on the firing line of life that, you know, God would give me an opportunity to carry this beautiful message, which you guys have given to me. And, you know, that's simply what this is all about. You know, it was started over 70 years ago by two guys, and here we are. You guys have been doing this deal for, 21 years now, and some form or the other, you know, we just keep carrying this simple message of hope to each other. And if you're new here tonight and this weekend, that's what this is all about. And I truly congratulate you for showing up. Because, you know, we had the same thing at home, and I was the same way. You know, when I first got into AA, Peter was talking about, and they said, "Hey, you want to go spend a weekend with 100 other guys?" Hell no, you know. I mean, that was the last thing in the world that I wanted to get trapped in doing. But, you know, if you're, and I know some of you are probably feeling that way, but stick with it, and it's a good thing. And this is where the healing takes place. You know, and also if you're new, you know, I need to tell you, when I showed up in AA, for a long time I would sit out there in those chairs and I would listen to the speakers and I would listen to what the speakers did that I didn't do. I was really all about that, man. I was interested in what you did that I didn't do. And I'd sit there and I'd listen to the speaker and I'd be thinking, well, I did that. I did that. I did not do that. Did not do that. Next night, next speaker, you know, I'd be thinking, did it, I did it, I did, did not do that. You know, every night, same thing, did it, didn't do it. You know, because I was looking for, the deal was, you know, the didn'ts were huge. If I could get enough didn'ts, I'm out of here. You know, I was trying as best I could to find out why I did not belong in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll be darned, I was at a meeting probably 6 weeks after in doing this, and a lady speaking, not even a guy. And I'm listening to this lady's story, and everything this woman did, I did. Everything. I'm listening to her story saying, man, I did that, I did that, I did that. Oh, I'm screwed. I did that too. But right at the end of her talk, she said she used to carry a half pint in her bra. I said, I did not do that. And I told some old guy about that after the meeting, and he said, Tim, what's your problem? I said, well, I'm kind of looking at what an alcoholic looks like. And he said, well, kind of like you. I said, no, and you know what I mean. You know, dirty old man, raincoat. And they said, no, we don't know what you mean. You know, and the deal was I looked around and I couldn't tell you were an alcoholic by looking at you, actually. You know, I mean, once in a while we get a dirty old man in a raincoat in here, but not normally, right? Like tonight, you know, actually dressed nice, you know, looking good, smiles on your face. I couldn't tell you were drunk by looking at you. And then I listened to your stories. The stories were all over the board, lots of different stories, lots of different things happened. So different stories, you know, and this is, and I want to put this out there tonight because I want to talk a lot about this hopefully over the weekend, you know, because here's what happened to me, you know, and I don't know about if you'll identify with this if you're new. But I kept sitting there, no matter what your stories were, what I started to realize, I heard you guys talking about three things. You were talking about being restless, irritable, and discontent. Ooh. You were talking about being apart from, not a part of. And you were talking about progressive patterns of dishonesty in your life. See, because when I heard those three things, I said, uh-oh. Because those three things have been part of my life from the get-go. Those three things I have wrestled with now 19 and a half years in Alcoholics Anonymous. Restless, irritable, and discontented. The book talks clearly about it. What is it? Don't know. Just got it. Absolutely have had it as long as I can remember. You know, in fact, sometimes the most powerful thing I hear when we're in the rooms is I say, hey, Alex, how's it going? And Alex will go, oh, shit, Tim, I don't know. I don't know. Something just ain't right. Something just ain't right. Do you know, Tim? Do you know? I'll go, yeah, I know. I know, Alex. I know what you're talking about there. See, whatever that was, and you hear us talk about our hole in the gut that the wind blows through, whatever it is. When I was 13 years old, and I found alcohol and put it on that, it took it away. And I never forgot that, and I really chased that for about the next 27 years. And see, the important part for me to understand was, you know, you're all trying to tell me real clearly is, Tim, guess what? When you take the alcohol away, guess what's going to be there? Irritable, restless, and discontent. That hole, whatever it was down deep inside of me that was broken, and I believe has been broken for a long time, you know, was going to take a certain type of fix. And you guys were going to tell me what that was in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The second thing you all were talking about was being apart from, not a part of. That is huge in my life. You know, there is still a part of me. You know, you would think you would get comfortable doing this after a while, going different places. When I get here, what will happen, there will always be a part, about an hour ago, where a little voice will get in my head and go, uh-oh, you don't belong here. They'll know you're from Kentucky, you know. They'll know you're different. They'll know, Tim, they'll know. And it's insane. It's always been there. There's a part of me that always wants to separate from the pack. There's a part of me that always wants to pick up and go. And see, that is so huge because the biggest thing you all told me when I showed up was just keep coming back. And here was the real important part. You said, Tim, keep coming back irregardless of how you feel, think, or believe. Ow. See, because my feelings, thoughts, and beliefs were everything to me. The bottom line was if little Timmy didn't feel good about it, if little Timmy didn't understand it, and if little Timmy didn't think he was going to work for him, then I'm certainly not going to do anything. And you guys said, well, then you're probably going to die. Because if you're thinking you're going to come in here and feel, think, and believe about, you know, this alcoholic's not from day one, it won't work that way. We would suggest for you, on the other hand, if you put your feelings, thoughts, and beliefs aside and you do what we ask you to do, you might have a chance to stay alive. And in fact, they even took it to the point to tell me, Tim, your feelings, thoughts, and beliefs are your disease. You know, and I didn't understand the word they were saying. But I understand that today because the thing that really first gift that God gave me in Alcoholics Anonymous was one day was just a little bit of teachability. Don't know where it came from. One day, just a little willingness to go to your stupid old meetings and do the stupid old stuff that you all were doing. You know, and I have to say it that way because that's pretty much how I felt about when I showed up. You know, apart from, not a part of. You know, and I think that's a huge piece of my alcoholism, at least. And, you know, so, I mean, that's why I need to keep coming and stay in what I call the loop of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got six grandkids, and I like to watch old movies with them. And one of my favorite movies of all time was E.T. the Extraterrestrial. And I tell you why, it came out in about 83 or 84, and I was all drunked up one night, and I was with this girl that I think I was engaged to, you know, one of those deals. And So we're watching this movie. If you ever remember that movie, there's a part in the movie where E.T., the little Martian guy, he gets all green and gray and crinkly. You know, he's drying up. You know, he's dying. He's dying, man. He's been cut off from the mothership, and he's dying. But all of a sudden, he looks up in the sky, and he goes, home, home, E.T., home. Man, tears just started coming down my face. This girl I was with said, "What is wrong with you?" I said, "Man, I know just how he feels." You know what? I really believe this. I could tell that same story in church. Nobody gets it. You tell that in AA, everybody goes, "Oh, yeah, man, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've been trying to get home my whole life." You know, home, you know, and thank God I found it here. And that's why I come back to meetings every day. It has become my home. I don't even need to understand what that's about. I just know it works. And I was telling Jules a minute ago, I couldn't wait to get out of Phoenix to get home to my people. You know, and I don't have any problem saying that anymore. And the last thing you all were talking about was progressive patterns of dishonesty in your life. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, man. Because what I knew always about myself is I lied when the truth was good enough. I lied when the truth was good enough. When I was a little kid, I was a pretty good athlete. But if I scored 20 points in a game and I came home, you'd say, "How many points you score?" I'd say 24. You know, got a B on the test. What'd you get? 10 B plus. You know, I mean, I did this from a little kid on, and I can even remember thinking, "What's that all about, Tim?" And here's what I've come to understand. Tim, why isn't the truth good enough for you? Why isn't the truth good enough for you? And what I know today is, if you're going to be a drunk, if you're going to live the life that we live, truth can't be good enough for you. You have to learn almost immediately that you got to live outside of that. And I did immediately, and I lived outside the truth, you know, until I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And 19 and a half years later, once in a while, I stumble across it, you know, since you guys have been helping me. But the truth has got to be good enough. You know, when I say that, I remember I was about 3 months sober. I got back in my house with my family, which was an on and off thing. I was up watching The Late Show with my daughter. She was 13 years old, and it's 1:45 in the morning. And she says, "Dad, can I order a pizza?" And I said, "Honey, no, don't do that. Your mom will go nuts." She said, "Come on, let me." I said, "All right, go ahead." 1:15 in the morning, doorbell rings. It's the pizza man. Well, of course, my wife, her mother, comes flying out of the bedroom screaming at my daughter, going, "What are you doing getting a pizza at 1:15 in the morning?" My daughter said, "Well, Dad said I could." My wife said, "You say she could?" I said, "No." And my daughter goes, "Dad, you were lying." I go, "I know, I do it all the time." So, you know, I say all that to say this, you know, restless, irritable, and discontent, apart from, not a part of, and progressive patterns of dishonesty in my life. See, now what I know today, what I didn't know when I showed up here, is you guys were going to give me the package. You were going to give me a solution for all of that. You know, restless, irritable, and discontent. You were going to teach me about hooking up with this power greater than myself that we're going to talk about this weekend. So that I wouldn't, when I was restless, irritable, and discontent, except picking up some drinks or some type of a drug, that I had some other mechanism to deal with that hole in my soul. The second thing, apart from, not a part of, you gave me the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I have to do is drag my raggedy old butt, you know, one day at a time in and hang out with you guys. And I don't have to be happy about it. I don't even have to be smiling about it. You just said to show up. Just show up and find some little bit of willingness, and maybe you'll have a chance. And, of course, the last part was the progressive patterns of dishonesty in my life. You gave me the 12 steps. And you said, "Tim, if you learn to practice these 12 steps, you're going to learn that you can live with your truth. And that whatever your truth is, it's good enough." And isn't that what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, we come in, and sooner or later, we're willing to share with each other, "All right, this is what really happened. All right, this is the truth about me." Now, for me, unless you're different from me, it took me a little while to get there. You know, I'm still working at that. But slowly, I'm starting to understand it's okay. You know, sometimes we take for granted, you know, what goes on in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, what we do when we do this deal, when we share with each other. Joe McQueenie, a lot of you know Joe and Charlie tapes. And I heard Joe tell a story one time before he died. He said he was at a big AA conference in a hotel somewhere, and he said, you know, he was walking down the hall. He was behind two ladies who weren't with the AA conference, but he overheard their conversation. And one lady said to the other lady, "Well, what do they do in there anyway?" And the other lady said, "Oh, it's awful. It really is. She said, I peeked in there last night. You know what they do? Well, one of them gets up there and says all these awful things about himself, and the rest of them laugh at him." And you know, if you think about it, If somebody off the street walked into here and listened to what we were sharing, they think, you know, what is this all about? But see, the deal is that that's where the gift comes from. That's where the healing comes from, is that we're willing to share our woundedness. You know, at any given point in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the less broken helping the more broken, you know. And I truly believe that. You know, I'm broken. I will always be broken. The good news is, you know, you guys have been willing on your days when you're a little bit better than me to share your experience, strength, and hope. And when I've been having a better day, then I'm able to do that for you, you know. And that's the way it's always going to be for me, and I've accepted that. You know, I'll just tell you very quickly about my drinking. I told you I grew up in that Irish Catholic family. It wasn't if you were going to drink. It was when and how good were you going to do it. You know, I mean, I was the oldest of seven kids, six boys and one girl. I always think it's interesting. A lot of drinking went on in my family for many generations, and I'll be darned if I wasn't the first alcoholic. Interesting. Because, and as far as what I could figure out, though, you know, as a kid, when I looked at my family, we had two types of people in my family. We had either nervous people or characters. I don't know if you had any of those in your family. We had a lot of characters. And what I mean by that was, you know, my dad would tell stories. Well, you remember when Uncle Mike came in all drunked up and Uncle Tom was sneaking in through the window and Uncle Mike woke up and he shot him, you know? And they'd all laugh and have another drink, you know? And my dad would say, boy, Uncle Tom, he was a character. And I'd be thinking, Dad, he's a killer. What are you talking about? You know? Lots of characters, lots of nervous people. And I think you know that what I'm going to say is the truth is, in both sides of my family, people were dying of the disease of alcoholism for generations. Generations. They just didn't call it, couldn't call it. What it really was. And, you know, and I say that because I'm very grateful that for whatever reason, you know, God on April 12th of 1990 made me willing to call it for the first time what it really was. And as a result of that, you know, I had a chance to start getting better. But anyway, as I told you, you know, I found alcohol at a very early age. And, you know, and I'll be real honest, it did for me, you know, what it needed to do. I mean, I was a tall, goofy, pimply, just totally shy, afraid of girls. I mean, I couldn't do any of that stuff. You know, I could shoot a basketball. You know, the only gift that I'd get, not the only gift, but one of the gifts that I had was I was an all-state basketball player in the state of Kentucky. And to translate that for you guys, that's like being an all-American hockey player in Canada. Basketball is a big deal down where I'm at. So my picture was in the paper a lot. My name was in the paper a lot. And the only reason I mention that is that that was my whole identity. That's who I was, you know, because beyond that, I was a totally fear-based, fear-ridden, totally afraid-to-live type of a kid. You know, I mean, it was just awful, you know, to be 16 or 17, because I didn't know how to do that stuff until I got a hold of a thing called ethyl alcohol. And when I got a hold of it, it was magic. It worked for me. It enabled me immediately to do what I couldn't do, as simple things as talking to girls and dancing and all that. And I just thought, well, you know what? If that works that way, then more is better, and, you know, the game was on. And I will say to you from this point forward in my story, and I really think this is the legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous, at least for me, is that alcohol would start to take from me at 17 years old everything that would ever mean anything to me. You know, and I say that because, you know, one of the things I've had three kids, I have grandkids. And I think when you get older, I'm 61 years old, you look back on your life. And, you know, and the truth was, I had dreams. I had aspirations. You know, I did. You know, I wanted to, you know, I was kind of a humble guy. I just wanted to grow up and be an NBA player and, you know, have the most beautiful girl on earth and just, you know, $3-4 million in my pocket. But other than that, you know, but no, seriously, I mean, I just like every kid. 18 or 19 years old, I just wanted to have a good life. You know, I wanted to go to college and get a degree and, you know, have a good wife and the family and be a good dad and all that stuff. I wanted that. I did. You know, when I'm saying that, because, you know, as I look back, what I know today that I certainly didn't know when I started that journey was alcohol was not going to allow that to happen. If you're an alcoholic of my kind, then simply you just can't live that type of life. You know, and I didn't know that then. And we were talking about this on the way over. It just does me so much good to see young people today in Alcoholics Anonymous. you know, people getting sober, you know, at 18 years old or 23 years old. I mean, I didn't have a clue, you know, till I was 42 years old. There was even a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. But anyway, at 18 years old, an all-state basketball player, I got a scholarship to Division I college. And that was a big deal in my life because not only was I the first member of my family to go to college, but to go on a scholarship with a lot of notoriety, I mean, that was a big deal. And I left Louisville in all my glory in 1966. Alcohol entered my life this way. By the first game of my sophomore year, in those days you couldn't play as a freshman, but the first game of my sophomore year, I showed up to that game so drunk that the other players had to hide me on the end of the bench so I wouldn't get thrown out of school. You know, and so this is like going to, I don't know what the big time college up here would be, but to go down to a UCLA game, and I played at St. Louis University, and we were in the league with Louisville and Cincinnati and Memphis State, and, you know, it wasn't like little league stuff. So this is like going to the Coliseum, and one kid on the end of the bench is just stumbling drunk. And what I want to share with you, and hopefully we'll talk a lot about this weekend, is that there were two things that happened that day that would become the two things that would just dominate my life for the next 20 years. I left class that day, and I was walking down the street, and the guy said, "Hey, Tim, you want to go get a drink?" And I said, "Well, sure." You know, I never said no. And I always had this type of mind. It said, "Well, yeah, I'll go have a couple beers, come home, get a nap, get up, take a shower, go to the game, be a hero." You know, that's what my mind said. I didn't know anything at 18 years old about a physical allergy or mental obsession. I didn't know, certainly know anything about phenomenon of craving. And if you'd have given me a lie detector test that day, I was going to have two beers. Because the basketball, you guys, was the one thing I would have told you. I'm not going to jeopardize that. I mean, that's who I am, man. I can't lose that. The other thing was this. The day before, the coach had said who was going to start the game and who were going to be the first three substitutes. And I wasn't one of them. And I had this thing that, you know, when my feelings got hurt and I felt discounted, I loved to drink. You know, in fact, this is the way this thing plays out for me the rest of my life. There's a part of me, and the way I like to translate it is, I start noticing, whether I'm on your team or I'm working for you in relationships, I can't help but start noticing that I'm not getting respect that a man of my stature should be getting. It's awful, guys. It has caused me so much trouble. I don't know about you guys. I mean, I notice I'm not getting the respect of my stature. It even happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way. I don't know about you guys. I start noticing some days I'm not getting respect the guy 19 and a half years sober should be getting. You know the good deal about AA? Nobody gives a shit. No. And that was real important to me when I showed up. You guys said, "Look, Tim, get this right. If you want what we have, come on in. And if you don't want to do it our way, then how about that meeting down the street?" Because, see, I have come to understand, the book clearly says it, that I have a disorder of the ego. Says it very clearly. The core of my problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. Didn't know if I bought that when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the longer I've been here, I said, how so much it is true. And so that's what happened that particular day. You know, one, I didn't understand that once I took that first drink that I wasn't going to stop. And two, you know, this whole idea of, you know, my self-centeredness saying to me once again, you're not getting what you deserve. And those two things, as I'm saying, would just permeate my life up until this day. You know, today I have some tools to deal with it. Crazy thing happened. You know, this is how my life started to go. And the reason I got drunk is I wasn't going to get in the game anyway. I was the first substitute that the idiot put in, right? So I'm out there, and this is not good because I'm very drunk. I'm seeing like three or four baskets up there, and there's like six basketballs bouncing around, and I'm about ready to puke. And I'm out there, and about half the people in the crowd know I'm drunk because they were at the same place I was drinking. I was in 2 minutes, you guys. I got two shots at the basket, and I swished them both, you know. So not only do I get caught, now I'm like the drunk who made two baskets, you know. I'm like the local hero, you know. And, of course, I'm going around for the next 2 weeks on campus telling everybody, well, hey, anybody can hit them when you're sober. It takes a real guy to hit one when you're drunk. The truth is that what I'm saying is at 19 years old, the most important thing that I saw in my life at that time now had taken a back seat to alcohol. You know, we had an old guy down around Louisville. He used to always say the analogy was, you know, alcohol was his friend, as was his buddy. He said he used to throw it in the car and he used to ride around and have a great time. He said, and then one day he woke up, he's in the back seat, alcohol was driving, and it was taking him wherever it wanted to go. And that happened to me at 18 years old. Alcohol started to dictate on a daily basis what I did, who I did it with, but most of all, where I ended up on any given day. And what it also did was it started to demand that I go against the morals and the values that my family had given me. Because, you know, if you're broke and you need to drink every day, then you need to do what you need to do. So I got into stealing. I got into taking tests for people because I had some brains when I was sober to make money. My nickname at that college became the Vagabond. You know, there's a great name for a 19-year-old kid, you know. And I got that name because that's how I lived. You know, I might end up at your house, under a tree, wherever the alcohol finished with me that day is kind of where I was done. And I just kind of trooped around for the next 2.5 years doing that. The basketball, as you're probably going to guess, came to an end, you know, right at the end of my sophomore year. I got by with it for a little bit, and it all came to an end. And you know what? When I look back at it, I didn't even care. You know, because I had found something that just seemed to work much better than that anyway. The whole thing had gotten to be kind of an irritation and a drag because the alcohol now was my main focus in life. What happened to me, though, I mean, you just can't hang around just drinking. And when I was in school there, and it came to 1970, and I had enough credits to graduate. My grades weren't very good, but I had enough credits to graduate. And if you can go back to 1970, and a lot of you can, there was only two things you can do in 1970. You can go to work, you can go to war. And I wasn't too interested in either one. You know, I kind of wanted to keep the party going if I could, was my idea. And any of you can go back to that time, Vietnam was not anywhere at that time in 1970 that anybody wanted to go. They had a draft lottery, and my lottery number was 6. You know, so I'm going. And so, and I say this because I don't know if you remember any part in your life where you had that thought, well, I better get it going. I better pull myself up by my bootstraps and get something done with my life. And this is the first time that I can remember, you know, facing that fear that, uh-oh, something's going to have to give here. Or you're going to be over there shooting them up pretty quick, Tim. And there was only two ways you could get out of the draft at that time. You could get married, which I thought that's awful drastic, or you could go to grad school, okay? Or you could have run up here, I guess. I forgot about that option. But anyway, I came up at 22 years old with a plan for my life. Again, I want you to stay with me on this. And some of you are really a drunk. You're going to understand it perfectly. If you're not, you won't. But my plan was exactly, and it's exactly the way I thought. I said, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go take the test to get into law school. We'll take the test to get into law school. I'm going to pass that test. I'm going to get into law school. I'm going to graduate from law school. Someday I'll run for Congress and then President of the United States. Now, if you're with me, it's a short trip for me as a drunk from street drunk to President of the United States. Yeah. I mean, that's just the way I think, you know. And as you probably guessed, I went and took the test. And, you know, having been a street drunk for really 4 years, I got an awful score on the test, and the law school turned me down. Now, as meager as it may sound to you guys, I mean, at that point in my life as I saw it was on the line. And I remember sitting around for days sweating this, you know, thinking, talking to the guys, what should I do? And one day it hits me, Tim, why don't you stop drinking, man? Why don't you stop drinking and study for that test? Because you can pass it. I know you can. You're not stupid. I've been a daily drinker for 4 years. For the next 5 weeks, I stopped drinking. Man, and it was awful at first. You know, I had the shakes. Everybody was partying, having a good time. But my life was on the line, you know. And for the next 5 weeks, I gave it the best that God had given me. You know, I studied for that test. I got a guy who was a tutor, and he came in and tutored me for that test. I gave it everything, guys, I had for 5 weeks. Came down to the day before the test. I made a slight change in my plan. It was a Friday afternoon. The test was on a Saturday morning. I said, all right, here's a new plan. I'm going to go out and have a couple beers so I can relax, come back, get a good night's sleep, get up, take that test, pass that test, get into law school, Congress, President of the United States. Same plan, one little change there. I left that Friday afternoon for those two beers. I didn't get back to that campus till the following Tuesday. Found out later on, I rode around St. Louis on a city bus about a day and a half, and what I know today is called a blackout. Physical allergy, mental obsession. phenomenon of craving. I remember when I was leaving for those two beers, all these guys grabbed me and said, "Oh, Tim, don't. Don't. What are you doing?" Or, you know, I said, "Guys, am I stupid? You think I'm stupid? I'm not going to blow this. I will be back in this dormitory by 9 o'clock. You can write it down." You know, and the next thing I would tell you, I believed that with every ounce in me. And I had no clue until I showed up here in 1990 that this first drink was the problem. You know, I spent my 27 years of drinking trying to find out where the cutoff point is. Where does a man stop where the consequences don't come? I never found it. And that's exactly what happened. There's a story within this story. About 2 o'clock that morning after I went out drinking, I knew I was going to take the test. And I went back to the dormitory and I found this real smart guy down the hall. And I paid him $25 to go take the test for me. In those days, you could get away with that stuff much easier than you can today. So he goes and takes the test for me. I stay drunk for 3.5 days. About 3 weeks later, we got the results of the test that this guy took for me. The damn guy got the highest score in the history of the law school. I mean, I opened this score up when it came in, and I ran down the hall and said, "You idiot! Look what you've done to me now!" You know? I think, like, I don't know the numbers. 800 was perfect. He had gotten a 799 on it. I had gotten a 400 on the one I took. Now I got two scores in my name, right? 400 and 799. You know, and I think you'll relate to this. You know, we talk about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization in our book. And here I'm 22 years old now, and I made an appointment to go see the dean of the law school because I'm thinking I better get to them before they get to me. And I made this appointment. I walk in, and the man's sitting there, you know, and he didn't say a word the whole time I was there. And I did, you know, only thing he could do, right? I started a lie. I said, "Well, Dean, you're probably wondering about the difference in those two scores." I said, "See, what happened is at the last minute, I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. I let some other guy take the test. How did he do?" You know, as if I didn't know. And he was looking at me, and I knew that he knew I was lying. You know, I had been there many times, but you don't have any choice. You know, but what I wanted to share with you guys, I'm 22, and I don't know why I remember this, but I turned to leave that law office that day, and for one brief moment, I knew the truth. One brief moment what went through my mind was, "Tim, you know the truth, man. It's the booze. The booze took the basketball out of your life for no reason, and it took your opportunity to go to law school because you got the brains, Tim, and you know it. It's the booze, man. It's the alcohol." I don't know why I ever remembered that, you know. It did not last long. You know, I walked outside of that office that day. There were two guys that I know. They said, "You want to get a drink?" I said, "Yeah." And that's 1970. You know, it was going to be 20 years before I showed up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to say to some old guys around Louisville, you know, "Hey, how come I didn't get it then? How come I didn't, you know, understand what was happening?" They said, "Tim, we don't know, but it didn't work that way. You know, this wasn't your time. The good news is, thank God that you're here, you know, and God gave you the grace and the on April 12th of 1990 for that one magic moment, you know, to show up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous." But what I wanted to share with you, and, you know, I guess maybe I can say this looking back on my life. I certainly couldn't see it for what it was then. I leave Louisville in 1966 in all my glory, right? Mr. Hero, Mr. All-American. I sneak back into Louisville 4 years later living a complete lie. Because I had to come back home and I had to tell people, "Well, I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. I just thought I'd come on home. I missed everybody." You know, until I got into AA, the only person who knew the truth was my mom. Thank God for mom. So she carried the secret for many, many years till I showed up in AA. But my point is, you know, what I know today more about my disease than I did when I showed up is that what it really takes from us is our dignity. It takes our integrity. It takes our character. It strips you raw of all that stuff. You know, and here I am at 22. Not only am I living my life on a lie, going to try to be an adult now, you know, living a complete lie. You know, I have pretty much lost all the integrity and the confidence of who I thought I could be. And I'm only 4 years into the deal. You know, interesting thing happened. I came home about to take the draft physical and I flunked the draft physical on a congenital birth defect. I thought, man, this would have saved me a lot of trouble if I'd have known this, you know. Of course, it never works that way, right? But anyway, I came back into Louisville and I got into teaching and coaching because that was the only thing that I was qualified to do. And I, I got a job coaching basketball and at an all-boys Catholic high school in Louisville. And my job was, I was the dean of students. Now, that's a bad job for a drunk. You know, you put a dean, man, I was in charge of discipline, you know. So you got a drunk in charge of discipline. And I tell this one particular story, and I think you'll understand why, because there's lots of stories from this part of my life that I'd rather not bring up. But one particular morning, I was sitting there like I always do, you know, trying to get through that first couple hours, you know, big old tomato head just throbbing and praying to get to 10 o'clock. But I'm sitting there at my desk waiting for all the kids to come in who are late, right? Well, this is back in the 70s where all the kids are out in the parking lot hitting a few doobies, you know, to get ready for class and whatnot. And I'm sitting there this one day and all hungover, and I look up and this kid standing up over me. He's got that long hair he had back in the 70s, you know, and his eyes were all glazed over, you know. You smell that reefer, and he was just floating over top of my desk like this, really. And all of a sudden he looked down and went, "Hey, Mr. Hyland, you're looking bad, dude." And I think I said something to him like, "Hey, by God, I'm in charge here, and don't you forget that." The reason I like to tell that story about that kid that day, that kid that said that to me that day last summer celebrated 27 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's a great member of AA. Yeah, that deserves a clap. He's a great A member. He lives down in Destin, Florida. The kid's a multimillionaire. He owns all this property and went down there. I went down there to speak at a conference a couple of years ago. And when I got off the airplane, he was there and he had his kids with him. He came up to me and said, "Hey, coach." He called me coach. He said, "Look, make you a deal. I won't say anything about you if you don't say anything about me." And you know what? I was sharing a little bit with Rick on this, you know. I don't know about you guys, but God has been so good to me to give me so many opportunities to redo all those areas of my life that I failed in so miserably. And one of them, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, over the last 19 and a half years, I've had the gift and the opportunity to sponsor some of those same boys that I tried to teach and coach back in the 70s. How about this for a special gift? How about having three brothers who I taught and coached back in the 70s all show up in Alcoholics Anonymous 3 years ago within 90 days of each other? And I got to sponsor all three of those kids. I still call them kids, and they're all 50 years old. But I got to sponsor all three of them. You know, it doesn't get any better than that. You know, I was telling Rick, it's an interesting thing. You know, in our meetings in Louisville, if they get up to the podium before me, you know, these kids that I sponsor now, it's of course they say, you know, "Hey, it's obviously why we're an alcoholic. We caught it from our coach, you know." But it's really been a blessing, you know, to have that done. And let me share this, because we have some time. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. It was an important part of my sobriety. One of those kids that I sponsored came into AA, his name was Chris. And not only had I taught and coached Chris in the 70s in high school, I had known him since he was a baby, because his family lived two streets from our family. They had seven kids like we had seven kids, but I was the oldest and he was the youngest in his family, so it was 10 years apart. And sure enough, about 7 or 8 years ago, he showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a good deal. You know, he was the first kid I sponsored, and oh, it's longer than that, I guess, 10 years ago. He was the first kid that I had coached that I sponsored in AA. And for 2 years, we had a great run. You know, we did the deal, man. We did our meetings. We did our steps. And all of a sudden, Chris quit showing up. You know, all of a sudden, he quit calling. Once in a while, he would stop by my office, and I'd say, "Man, what's going on?" He'd say, "Well, Tim, you know, I'm not doing much AA anymore." He said, "But, you know, I'm doing good stuff. I'm doing good stuff." He said, "I'm working in the Big Brothers program, Tim. I'm helping these little kids in the ghetto. And it's really a good thing. It's kind of like what we do in AA. We help people." You know, I remember telling him what the old timers had told me. I said, "Chris, look, let me just pass on something that's been passed on to me. I'm a drunk, and I need to be around my own kind. I need to be around other drunks." I said, "I'm sure you're helping these little kids, you know, in the Big Brothers program. But, man, I'd really like to see you come back around Alcoholics Anonymous." And, you know, he didn't do that. And what happened to him was his life took an unexpected turn, huh? Just like all of ours do. And what happened to him was he had a little girl by a woman. And for the first year of that baby's life, the mother didn't want it. And he raised this little girl from an infant for the first year of its life. And as you may guess, what a special bond he had with that little girl. But then in the second year, the mother, out of just meanness, really, went to court and took that baby away from him and would not let him see that child. And what happened was, is what our book talks about, he went into that obsession of mind, that loop thinking. And he started to call me and he said, Tim, I can't take this. I can't handle this. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I'll never forget it. I don't know what year it was now, but it was a couple of days before St. Patrick's Day in March. And he called me one night and I said, well, Chris, let's get together in the morning, son, because all I know to tell you to do, we'll get together and we'll do a third step and we'll try to turn this thing over to God, because that's the only solution I have for you. It's the only one that's been given to me. And what I want to share with you, you know, that never happened. We never got together that next morning. Because about 2 in the morning that night, another guy I sponsored said, Tim, I'm at Chris's house and he's dead. And I went over there, guys. I wanted to share. I'm about 7 years sober, I guess, at the time. And I was kind of flaking out a little bit on the outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was getting kind of bored with it. Wasn't quite getting, you know, into the meetings the way I used to. But that night I went over there and here's what I saw. I looked down. Here's this blind, 6'2" blind kid that I'd known my whole life. Great athlete, by the way. And underneath his lawn chair was an empty quart of Jack Daniels. And in his lap was the hose that came out of his exhaust of the car sitting right next to him. And he was just slumped in that chair, and the policemen were here, and they had the yellow tape around him. And it was a pivotal changing, formatting or transforming moment in my sobriety. Because I want to tell you what, I looked at that kid sitting there. And what went through my mind was this, look, you can make me the deacon of 51 churches, you know. You can make me the head of the Boy Scouts of America. You can make me the head of the Mother Teresa fan club. You know, you can make me all the wonderful things that the world says I can do. But if I forget, first and foremost, what I am and where I belong, you can forget about the rest. You know, I truly believe that. That was such a message to me. See, I got guys today, I don't know about you all, that I came into AA with in Louisville. I don't ever see them at the meetings. And I say to him, hey, man, what's going on? They go, oh, Tim, coaching the Little League. Real involved in my church, Tim. I'm a deacon. And I think, man, I hope it works for you. I really hope it works for you. See, because what I was taught is that if I realize what I am, there's only been one thing in 70 years that works for a guy like me, and it's called the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I can keep that first and foremost, then all that rest of that stuff, you guys, I can have it. I'm on boards of directors today. I have a church today. I go to watch my kids play, my grandkids play, you know. But it's only because I show up here first. It's only because, you know. And I say that because, you know, Chris never got to carry his own message. But, you know, I remember going to his funeral, and he was the only alcoholic in his family. And his mother said to me, and I know her my whole life, she said, here's what she said. She said, Timmy, she said, I don't understand. I said, well, don't you understand? She said, I don't understand how a problem in life can get that big where you pick up a quart of whiskey and you take your own life. I don't understand that, Tim. You know what? And I looked in her eyes and I realized she didn't understand at all. But I'll tell you what, I did. I understood it perfectly. And I understand that I can get to that point again. I see it every day in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you see, that's what I'm saying, guys. And that's why sometimes I tell Chris's story. Because, you know, I don't know if it does anything for you, but boy, it brought me back to where I needed to be. It's the reason, you know, somebody's asking me about this today. You know, how do you like doing this? I said, well, I don't like the airplane rides, you know. I mean, that's gotten to be a beating, right, anymore to get on an airplane and go through all that stuff. But this part of it, you know, being in front of you guys, being around other people that have the same problem that I have and are working the same solution, it's all I have. It's my life. And as long as that stays there, I'm pretty sure that the rest of it can be there. You know, also when I came back from college, I got married to my high school sweetheart. And we may go ahead and do about a 2-hour workshop on this sometime this weekend. Unless none of the rest of you have any problems with relationships. I mean, I don't. But I got married to my high school sweetheart in 1970. We got divorced for the first time in 1983. I remarried her in 1985. We got divorced again in 1987. I remarried her in 1990 when I got sober. And we got divorced again in 1994. You got it? You know, that's not too bad. You know, you tell people in your office that, they go, what? Tell people nay, they go, oh, hell, sounds normal to us, you know. What I will say generically about that today is, what's that all about? Well, it's all about alcoholism and everything that goes with it. I love them, I hate them, He's good. He's bad. You know, if you don't know, there's a thing called alcoholism in the middle of any relationship. It's an impossible deal. And the truth about that was, you know, historically, you had two pretty good people doing the best they could until this whole thing cleared up about what the real problem was. You know, she's actually a pretty neat lady. I also had three beautiful children born, you know, in that marriage. And since we're all guys here, I'll share this with you. How about as God's gift to you having your oldest son born on Christmas morning? In 1971, that was God's gift to me. What a blessing. 9 a.m., Christmas morning, oldest son. And I missed the gift. And I was to miss lots of those gifts because the best I could do that Christmas morning, I was in the hospital, but I was in the men's toilet with my head in the toilet bowl spitting up whiskey. And all I could think about is I got to get out of here and I got to get somewhere where I can get a drink. And I never even got into the room where my wife was and my Christmas baby was. I left the hospital to go find a drink before I even saw that child. You know, I want to share something, too, with you because this became important to me. I really didn't see that kid grow up, my oldest child, because by the time I got sober, he was about 17. And he, as you might guess, had been through it by that time. He had seen a lot of stuff he didn't like and didn't want to see. But I'm 6 months sober, right? I'm 6 months sober in AA, and he says to me one day, "Hey, Dad, can I talk to you before I go off to school?" I said, "Well, sure, son." And of course, I immediately think, uh-huh. He probably wants to tell me how proud he is of me that I'm 6 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm pretty sure that's probably it. And we have our little meeting. I said, "What is it, son, you'd like to say before you go?" And he said, "Dad, I only have one thing to say." He said, "I hate you." He said, "I hate you, Dad. Let me tell you why." He said, "I hate you because all you think about is you." He said, "Even since you stopped drinking, Dad, all you think about is you. Bye." Man, you know, I was just stunned. I said, "I can't believe that kid said that to me." And I made the most crucial mistake I've ever made in Alcoholics Anonymous. I took my old whiny story to a bunch of old timers in the south end of Louisville. They were not kind. They were not kind. We had an old fellow named Jack Sullivan that some of you might have heard along the way. Jack was a great old timer in the area. And he said, "Sit down." And I learned a lesson that I didn't like, but it's one I pass on to my guys every day today. He said, "I'm going to tell you something." He said, "Look, you drank for 27 years. You think you're getting credibility back in your life in 6 months? Ain't going to happen, Tim. Ain't going to work that way." He said, "But here's how it will work, and we'll promise you this. You will get credibility back in your life one day at a time by not drinking and doing the next right thing." And you know what? It doesn't even sound too good now, you know? And it certainly didn't sound any good then. But it absolutely was the truth as big as I've ever heard it. You will get it back, Tim, but you only get it one day at a time by not drinking and doing the next right thing. And what I need to share with you guys, 8 years into my sobriety, I was living by myself, which was common, obviously. And that Christmas baby called me from Seattle, Washington. He was in Seattle, and his butt was on fire, and his life was falling apart. But he called his old man, and he knew his old man was different. He knew his old man listened to him when he talked to him finally. He knew his dad was helping people in Alcoholics Anonymous. He knew that. And he said, "Dad, can I come home and can I live with you?" And he came home when I was 8 years sober, and he spent a year with me in that gentle healing, you know, one day at a time by not drinking and doing the next right thing started to happen. And today, you know, 19 and a half years after the deal, or 11 years since then, 5 years ago, I helped that kid start his own business. He's a glass artist. He's studying in Seattle, and he's doing very, very well. He has two twin 8-year-old girls, and I will promise you he loves every second, every minute that those two little girls get to spend with their pawpaws. They are ready to have another little girl any minute. You know, it could be that today, in fact, could be tomorrow. And they are so excited, you know, anytime they get to bring their kids to spend with their pawpaws. And I say that, guys, because if you're new, you know, if you're new, I know you want it all back. If you're new, I know you want, you know, when I first came in, my thinking was kind of like, "Okay, everybody, let's call this thing even, you know?" And there was nothing even about anything, right? But I wish it would. But one day at a time, but not drinking. Growing up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll promise you this, that the credibility that does come back is like none other than I would have ever expected or ever asked for, you know. So if you're new and you're struggling with that, and I know that you are. You know, I did the teaching and coaching thing for the best I could. It was a mess. I was sanctioned. I was caught drinking. I was demoted from assistant principal to another job, and I finally decided that I wasn't getting the respect that a guy of my stature should be getting. And I left teaching and coaching. I did what every drunk eventually does. I started my own business, right? Got to try that sooner or later. So I left and in 1980 started my own insurance business. And again, let me tell you about the 80s, keeping in mind that I got sober April 12th of 1990. I've already told you, got divorced for the first time from my original wife, my most frequent wife, I call her, in 1983. We divorced in 1980, remarried in 85, divorced in 87, remarried again in 1990. I was engaged to two other women in between time. I was in a nut house on three different occasions. I got locked up 8 times for public intoxication. I got shot at. I got cut up with a beer bottle, and I lost $250,000. And I was thinking, this is going okay. Like, we're always the last to know, you know, and we're always the last to know. 1983, you know, I was living with Mom and Dad. You know, I started my own company. I remember I used to run into guys I went to high school with. They said, "Hey, Tim, what are you doing now?" I said, "Well, I'm president of my own company." They say, "No kidding. Where are you living?" I said, "Well, Mom and Dad." From 1982 to 1985, I went through 5 psychiatrists, and that was a real simple deal. I kept them until they started talking about alcohol. They started talking about alcohol, fired them, got me a new guy. You know, I was taking every antidepressant they ever made, drinking whiskey and beer on a daily recipe. And if you're trying that one, it did not work very well for me as I look back. But that's the best I could do. New Year's Eve, 1985. You know, I don't know if you remember these days where you couldn't live drunk and you couldn't live sober. And I like to say what I remember the most was that particular day, the thrill was gone. The thrill was gone. No matter how much whiskey I drank that particular day, the buzz was gone. There was no buzz. There was no buzz coming back. It was a hollow thing going on all of a sudden, and I couldn't do anything about it. And that was my first visit to the asylum. My brother Tommy drugged me up to our local nut house, which is called Our Lady of Peace. And I want to tell you the story as I remember it. I always say someday I'm going to find this nurse and get her version. But this is my alcoholism through and through, because this is exactly how it went. They put me into the nut house, and I was drunk. I was demoralized. I was as suicidal as I've ever been, I guess, and I didn't know what to do with that. But they sent me down this little room down there. I guess it was a detox room. And this big old nurse came in. I remember that she must have weighed 400 pounds. And she sat down next to me, and she looked at me, and she said, "Well, honey, tell me about it. Honey, tell me about it." I said, "All right, I will." I said, you know, in 1983, a couple years ago, my first wife threw me out for no reason that I can think of. And then I got engaged to this other woman, and she took off with a ring before I even paid for it, you know. And, oh, yeah, you know, I'm working with idiots, you know. I have to do everything in my work. They don't do anything. Oh, yeah, did I tell you my dad went to prison when I was 10 years old? And all of a sudden, I found myself just wrapping all this stuff. I didn't know where it was coming from. I did notice I was starting to feel better as I was talking. Looked at the nurse after a while. She didn't look too good, you know. Maybe I'm there an hour, hour and a half. 2 hours, I don't know. But she looked me right in the eye and she said, "Well, honey, you certainly have a right to feel the way you do." I went, "God, you are so right, lady. What was I thinking of? If people have messed over you like they messed over me, by God, you'd drink and be depressed too." I'm telling you the truth, guys. I hadn't been there 2 hours and I was cured. You know, I spent the next 28 days in the hospital kind of trying to help everybody else, you know. You know, I thought they made me head of the stress class. You know, I got a blue ribbon for the best ceramic and the shop thing. You know, I mean, it was nuts. See, because what had happened was I had momentarily forgot that it wasn't me at all. It was you guys. It had always been you. You know, that's what I had momentarily forgot. I mean, this is honest. Exactly. You talk about insanity. About halfway through that trip in the asylum, I was walking down the hall one day, and the nurse says, "Would you like to pass out tonight?" I must have thought she said, "You want to pass out tonight?" I said, "What?" She said, "Yeah, you're doing good. If you want to go out for a couple hours, as long as you're back by curfew, it'll be all right." I said, "That's great." I call my best buddy. He picks me up. We go right to the watering hole, you know. Slam down 6-8 beers, you know, get a couple shots of whiskey. Got a big old bottle of wine sitting up around the table drinking it. I'm telling about all the people I'm helping back to the hospital. quarter to 11. We're both drunk. And I said, hey, I got to be back with a curfew at 11. And so we pile in the car. We get back to the nut house, and I'm getting out the passenger side to go back in. I look over at the driver's side. He's just got tears streaming down his face. I said, what is wrong with you? He said, Tim, you don't belong in there. I do. Oh, man. And I think I said something like, you know what? I think you're right. And when I get out of here, I'll help you. You know, that's 1985. It was 5 years before I was going to get to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what I did, guys? I came out of the asylum and I did what I always did. I got me a new girlfriend, got me a new place to live, got me a new business partner. I started over. I was always starting over. You know, and if you listen to our stories in AA, we're the best starter overs in the world. Can't finish much of anything, but we can flat start over, man. And that's what I did. You know, came back out, got married to my most frequent wife again in 1987, I guess it was. And bought it, you know, changed houses, changed the scenery. And, you know, as you've heard so many times before, wherever you go, there you are. And I was still there. The drunk was still there. And it only got worse and got worse. And she finally threw me out late 1989 again. And I lived the last 6 months of my drinking, living in a guy's basement in the south end of Louisville. And I can't tell you anything, you know, happened there that I can remember that was significant, except, you know, now I was the president of my own company living in a basement. You know, I thought it was kind of a step up from mom and dad's in some way. But April 12th of 1990, you know, it was kind of anticlimactic. I had been out with some guys. I came home to that basement, and I sat up, drank a couple beers, and dozed off. And I got up like I always did the next day and went into my office. April 12th of 1990. You know, and I'm in a business, guys, where the phone rings constantly. People are in and out of my office constantly. It's that type of business. April 12th of 1990, I sat down there about 7:30, quarter eight, and I did not move a muscle, you know, till almost quarter till noon 12. The phone never rang one time. Nobody ever came in the office that day. And I never moved a muscle. You know, and the book talks about that moment of clarity. That book talks about it, and I guess that's what went on. Because the only sensation I had was, it's over, it's over, it's over, Tim, and you know what the problem is. And I reached in my desk drawer and I found a directory of the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that a guy had given me like 2.5 years before. And it was right there at my right hand that whole time. And I picked it up that day, and for whatever reason, because I didn't know what else to do, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 19 and a half years ago. And what I want to share with you is that, you know, over the last 19 and a half years, you know, I mean, I have an honesty. I've laughed sometimes so hard in my sobriety, I thought my gut was going to split. But I've also probably cried as hard or more deeply than I ever thought I could. I have felt sadness more acutely than I ever thought was possible. You know, and the thing was, is that, you know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was kind of really hoping that, you know, sobriety was going to be the absence of problems in my life. You guys said, no, Tim, that's not what it's about, buddy. And thank God. What you did say was, here's the hit, Tim. Being sober is that you get to do life and everything that goes with it. And what rang a bell with me was, back in my day, my wife used to say this to me. She used to say to me, and used to make me so mad, she'd say, Tim, you're not even here when you're here. I said, what do you mean I'm here? She said, no, you're not. And see, what I understand today about the disease of alcoholism, it's a disease of body, mind, and spirit. And if you can only bring your body and you can't bring your mind and you can't bring your spirit, you can't be a dad. You can't be a husband. You can't be a granddad. You can't be much of anything. Who wants a body? And see, so many times, guys, that's all that I could ever bring when I did that. See, I didn't understand the spiritual malady of alcoholism. I didn't understand the obsession. And the obsession was this. Either I was drinking, I was thinking about drinking, or I was thinking about me. You know, that's who I was. And you know what? If that's your deal, you pretty much are cut off from life. You pretty much can't be much of anything. I just didn't know that. But the greatest gift you've given me, you said, Tim, here's the good thing about sobriety. You get to be a part of life, body, mind, and spirit. And thank God for that. In the last 19 and a half years, you know, I've had that one kid who killed himself. I had a guy that sponsored, got shot down in the streets of Louisville about 3 years ago. I was 8 years sober. I've lost my mom. I've lost my dad. You know, I've had another divorce in sobriety. You know, life continues on. The good news is, most of the time, I've been able to show up in body and mind and spirit. And that was the promise that you gave me. And that's what recovery, and that's what sobriety has done to me. And let me tell you what that gift is. That means a guy like me can set up in a treehouse with his three little 8-year-old grandkids for 2 and 3 hours at a time. And a guy like me didn't do that. See, because I couldn't, because my mind needed to be somewhere else. I can sit on the floor and play trucks with my 4-year-old grandson for hours. And you have to understand, guys, a guy like me just couldn't do that. And see, that's the gift. That's the gift, is I get to be a part of things finally. I don't know about you guys. I didn't even realize I wasn't. I didn't even realize that life was going on without Tim Hyland most of the time. And I say that to you because our book very clearly says it. You know, and what you realize, we're going to talk about this weekend, is this: when we stop drinking, is this the beginning of clearing up this thing called alcoholism, which is a spiritual malady that scars and mars the spirit. Okay? And we need to learn, as the book talks about, to move out of this crazy thing called our mind, where the problem centers, to our heart, you know, and learn to participate and speak in the language of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the language of the heart. You know, when I showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous, I told you I owed people about $250,000, and I owed that to people who really wanted it back. They really did, and they really bothered me about it a lot, which I thought was not very nice. You know, you're trying to get sober, and people are bothering you all the time about this. And I'm going to tell you this story because this will also, you're going to hear it over and over this weekend, because it's become the pivot for my sobriety. Because, you know, I was so fear-based, and I owe $250,000, and like any good drunk, I'm going into my office every day thinking, you know, like we all do, one big deal to come up with $250,000, right? And I'd get all nervous, and I'd shuffle papers backwards and forwards, and, you know, about 10 o'clock in the morning, I'd just freeze up, go home, get in my bed, get in the ball, and just, you know, hide. And I'm a year sober almost doing this, and it's driving me insane. I'm at a meeting like this one night, and I'm whining about my business, and this old guy says, sit down here with me and talk to me about that business of yours you owe so much money. I said, well, Our business opens at 8 o'clock. He said, good, Tim, be there at 8 o'clock. Not 8:10, be there at 8 o'clock. What's next? I said, well, I'm supposed to make my sales calls. He said, good, Tim, go make your sales calls. What's next? I said, well, I'll go to lunch. He said, well, wait, Tim, go to lunch. And Tim, come back from lunch. I thought, that's a good one. I had a problem with that. What's next? I said, well, I'll come home and do my paperwork. He said, good. What's next? I said, well, work's over at 4:45. He said, good, Tim, go home one time. Have dinner with your family. Go to your meeting. Come home, say your prayers, and then he leveled me with the big one. And he said, and Tim, do the same thing the next day. And I remember thinking, man, what a concept. You know, every day? You like do that every day? And see, what I've come to learn, what I call it today, is that he was telling me to learn to do the stitches and leave the patterns up to God. Tim, you do the stitches and leave the patterns up to God. That sounds so neat, see, but for me, guys, when I start stitching, I immediately start thinking, what am I making? Hat, pants, shirt, and when's it going to be done, and what color is it? And they say, no. You just stitch, and trust this, that the pattern that's going to develop is going to be far better than the one that you would ever pick out in the first place. Just stitch. You know, and I say that because that's become something, and when I talk to the guys I sponsor, they get sick of listening to this, but I actually got it from my own sponsor. Do the stitches and leave the patterns up to God. I'll tell you a real quick sequel to that story. 5 years later, I come home from a home group one day, and I just stitched. I did what that old man told me, and I remember many days thinking, this is stupid. I'm never going to pay that money off, but I kept stitching. 5 years later, I came in one day, and it was 7 phone messages. 6 of them were from AA guys, and the last one was from the local business newspaper. So I called my AA guys, and then I called this reporter. This reporter says, Mr. Hyland, look, we would like to do an article on your business. It's been recognized as one of the fastest growing businesses of its kind in the Louisville area. I said, that'd be great. She said, here's her first question. She says, would you tell me what it was you did to start turning your business around? I said, well, see, our business opens every day at 8 o'clock. And I went right through the deal, guys, right through the deal, you know. And I go to lunch, I come back from lunch, I do my paperwork, I go home, and I do that every day, man. And there's like, when I'm finished, there's like silence on the other end of the phone. And I immediately know there's not going to be an article. And see, the other thing, there's a part of me screaming, tell her that you came up with this incredible idea. You pulled yourself up by like your bootstraps and you saved this thing. There's a part of me wanting to tell her that. But there's another part of me said, no, tell her the truth. Tell her this. All you did, stupid, was the simple stitches of suiting up and showing up every day. And this incredible pattern developed. It took me 9 years, guys, to pay off that $250,000. You know, and I did it the same way that old man told me, by just simply suiting up and showing up one day at a time. You know, I have lots of problems, as you heard, with relationships, and there's nothing funny about that. You know, I was telling somebody the other day, and this is honest God, true story. And early in my sobriety, obviously I was having marital problems. So I found these three geniuses in AA. Three geniuses. And they said, Tim, your problem is you don't have any communication skills. He said, you basically came into AA with survival skills. And there's only two, fight or flee, which is basically screw you, I'm out of here, right? That's the translation. And then when he said that, I thought, you got a point there. You know, that kind of was my whole arsenal. So he said, we're going to give you some tools to work with here. So the first guy says, Tim, when people confront you or she says something to you, you just say back to her, well, how can I help? How can I help? So I said, all right, that's pretty good. She said, because it throws it back in their lap if you ask them how you can help. And I said, well, what if you find people don't want your help? And they said, well, you just tell them, I'm sorry you feel that way. So I got, how can I help? I'm sorry you feel that way. And the third idiot says, hey, invalidate people by telling them they may be right. So, man, I got my tools, right? How can I help? Sorry you feel that way. Hey, you might be right. And like any good drunk, I'm wearing it out, right? For the next 6 weeks at work, at home, I'm just, how can I help? Hey, sorry you feel that way. Hey, you might be right. Came home from my men's Tuesday night meeting one time. I mean, it was a great meeting, right? Spiritually, I'm just way up there. I'm kind of coming in the house on my wings, you know, just really. I'm really up there, and I go sit down at the kitchen table like this, and all hell's breaking loose in my house. You know, my wife's yelling at my daughter's yelling at her brothers, and they're yelling at her, and I'm sitting there waiting, and my wife comes into the kitchen. Before I could say anything, she said, and don't give me that how can you help shit. I said, honey, I'm sorry you feel that way. And then she said, you asshole. I said, well, you might be right. Oh, man. Now, here's the deal. Here's a disclaimer. You know, I usually have a couple of new guys who are out there writing that stuff down like this. If you use them, you're on your own. You're on your own. You didn't hear it from me. Let me finish up or head home with this, is that, you know, the divorces weren't funny. We laugh about it. But, you know, divorce when you're drunk is one thing. Divorce in sobriety is not, it's hurtful. When I was 4 years sober, you know, I mean, on my way to being a giant in Alcoholics Anonymous, I lose my marriage. And it was hurtful. And that was to my original wife. And I marched on from 1994 to about 1998, you know, helping newcomers. And, you know, not that I didn't want to have a relationship. We all do. But, you know, I realized things weren't going too well in that area. But I did start thinking, you know what? Maybe the problem is that I need to find somebody who's on the same spiritual path as me. Yeah, that's it. I need to find a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we can march down the path of road to happy destiny together. That's what I need. And you know what? She showed up like that. I don't know where she came from, you know. Kind of made it happen. And really, she's a good AA person, and we had about an 8-month courtship. And we had this big AA wedding in 1998, you know. And I actually thought, guys, it was the best thing that God ever created. Lasted 8 months. 8 months, and it crashed down like nothing. You know, it was just really painful. So now it's right in the middle of AA. And, you know, and the truth was with me, it was a real transforming point, because I thought, you know, deep down, what's your problem, man? Tim, what is wrong with you? What is your problem that you cannot have a decent relationship with somebody of the opposite sex? You know, and it was very, very humbling, and it really put me in, and hopefully we'll talk about this weekend, and looking at what the 6 and 7 step were all about. Because, see, I had kind of misinterpreted that. I thought it was my job to kind of get rid of those character defects. And I didn't understand it. That was nothing about me getting rid of them, that it was all about me getting about the business of helping God's kids, and that He would take care of that. And, you know, I pretty much did that. And the guy who's my sponsor today, Don M., you know, worked with me a lot on that. And I went on and I really dedicated myself to helping other people and got clear of that thing for a while and, you know, went forward. And just to show you, you know, how God works in strange and very mysterious ways, 2 years after that or a little bit after that, I'm at home one day and my mother of my children, my most frequent wife, calls and says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, nothing, you know, I'm by myself." She said, "I'm taking the kids on a vacation. Would you like to go?" I said, "Well, sure. You know, I mean, I got nothing to do." And we took these kids on a vacation, you know, to South Carolina. And here's somebody, you just heard the story, that I've known since we were 17 years old. But this time we went, you know, on a whole different basis. We went as friends. We went as co-parents, you know. We went as people who loved these children, you know, and had been divorced at that time, 5 to 6 years, you know. And what happened was, incredibly, a whole new relationship developed. You know, we started actually being friends for the first time in our life. We actually started being parents and co-parents for the first time in our life. You know, and we just started walking this incredible different journey, you know. And basically, I eventually sold my house and I moved in with her. And 2002, actually, we were sitting there one day and I looked at her and she looked at me. I said, "Well, what do you think?" You know? Here's the hit, guys. On November the 28th, this coming November the 28th, we will be celebrating our 39th gross anniversary. Don't ask me what the net is. I have no idea. And you know what? It's totally incredible. I mean, the life we have today. She's become my best friend. She's become my best buddy. We walk together every day. You know, she comes on trips with me quite a bit today. You know, and I remember saying to my sponsor, "Is this pretty insane?" He goes, "Well, yeah, it's pretty insane." But he said this. He said, "Tim, maybe if our book is about anything, if the steps are about anything, they're about transformation." Transformation. You know what transformation is? You don't know when it's going to happen. You don't know how it's going to look. And you don't know who's going to be involved with it. Because you know what? God transforms. We don't. We don't. We plant the seed, we water it, God grows it, right? And, you know, I have to believe that's what's happening. I have to believe, because you heard what you just heard. I have to believe some days when, you know, she hasn't changed in many ways than when I knew her, you know, many years ago. But somehow I look at it and go, what was the problem in the first place? Now, something has changed. The power has been redistributed somewhere along the line. You know, that's all I can tell you. And we're very, very happy. You know, I'll tell you this, and we'll head toward the barn here, is that I had three kids. I told you, the Christmas baby and another son. And then my daughter, my baby girl, was her daddy's daughter. You know, in fact, this kid, when she was a little toddler, her first little phrase was, "Is I'll do it myself." Her second little phrase was, "You're not the boss to me." You know? So I knew she was going to be the one, and she was. She was a hellcat, and she was just like me, and she drank just like me, and just, you know, drove her mother insane. And she, about, I guess, 7, 8 years ago now, left Louisville. Very talented girl, just beautiful, beautiful, tall, blonde, blue-eyed. She's an artist and just was a great athlete. But, boy, she liked to drink. And she left Louisville and she went to Chicago to the Art Institute there and went on a run from there to Los Angeles. And, guys, about 7.5 years ago, I guess it is now, she came back to Louisville to visit. And here's what I saw. You know, I saw my baby girl, and her eyes were all caved in, her cheeks were caved in, her teeth were falling out. You could almost count her ribs. She was living in her car in the streets of Los Angeles, you know. And she was living strictly on a liquid diet. And of course, when she was home to visit us, you know, she's like, nothing's wrong. You know, and I knew what was happening. I knew she was dying of the disease of alcoholism. And she left, and she went back to L.A., you know, and I waited, as many of us have to do, for that call. Because I knew one day there was going to be a call one way or the other. And about 7.5 years ago, I got that call, you know, and it was her. And she was alive, but barely. And she said, "Daddy, I need help. And what can I do?" And here's what I wanted to share with you guys. By that time, I'm 12 years sober in AA. I'm sponsoring all kinds of guys at home. You know, I'm speaking, you know, out a lot. And, you know, if you bring me anybody, I know what we're going to do, right? We're going to get together. We're going to get on our knees and do the third step. I want to tell you something. All of a sudden, when it's your baby girl, and she's 2,000 miles away, and you can't get your hand on her. I mean, I want to tell you what went through my head. All of a sudden was, "Hey, Tim, what do you think about A&A now, buddy? What do you think about these 12 steps now, buddy? What about this God of your understanding now, buddy? Is it good enough for her? And I need to be honest with you guys. There was one part of me that was so strong I wanted to get on an airplane and go out there and bring my child home. But there was another part that came from somewhere. And what I said to her was, honey, here's a man's name in Los Angeles in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you'll call him. And I hung up that phone, you guys. I want to tell you, I cried like a baby for an hour. Because I thought, you know, it's 50-50 here, whether I'm going to go bring her home in a box or she'll make that call. But here's what I also wanted to tell you, is what I also knew I had told her the truth. I only have one thing to give. And it's the same thing that Bill gave to Bob. It's the same thing that my sponsor gave to me. I don't have anything else. It's the only thing that I know that's worked for people like me and like you for 70 years. I don't have anything else to give. I don't care if it's my child or not my child. I did know that. And it was a tremendous, you know, point of surrender for me in my program. You know, I can't tell you. But, you know, the good news, I need to tell you this. Last July, her mother and I got on an airplane, and we went out to Los Angeles, California, to help her take her 7-year cake. She's a beautiful member of Alcoholics Anonymous out there, and her life's going great, and I just can't tell you. You know, and that's what I'm saying. I'll finish up by saying this. And if anything comes through this weekend, is that I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope you can see why. You know, because I want Alcoholics Anonymous to be here, you know, just like it was for me, in the same form it was for me, just like it was for her in Los Angeles when she made that call. And I got 6 grandbabies, 7 on the way. And I've already picked out 2 of those little suckers, you know, that, you know, looks like they might be the one. But if they are, I want the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to be here, and I want the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous to be in place the same way they've been in place here. And so, you know, I really look forward to being here this weekend with you guys. You know, we'll try to talk about the steps a little bit. And, you know, and I'll just say this. I don't know anything. You just heard, you were probably saying, boy, that guy's story, I think I'm going to go on home. But I don't have anything that I know. I can share with you what my experiences have been and what other people have shared with me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look forward to doing that this weekend. And keep a close eye on me, because if you see me kind of wandering around down there by the lake with that goofy look in my face, just come down. And what's happening is I'm probably starting to notice I'm not getting respect to the man of my stature. Love you guys. See you later.